Hello and welcome to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. On today's show, Haiti and design and architecture. A week after the earthquake, bodies are still being dug up from under the rubble. Wounds are being treated, supplies are on their way. And yet, there's already talk of rebuilding and a better tomorrow. We'll talk about all that today. There is architecture that can help defy earthquakes and hurricanes. But will it get built in Haiti? Can sustainable and decent design emerge out of messy politics? Can it house very poor people in a vastly overpopulated capital city? Before we talk solutions, let's take a brief look at Haiti's architectural history and the story it tells us. Patrick Sylvain is a Haitian-born poet and instructor at Brown University. He's fascinated by the connection between space and power.
In Haiti, unfortunately, it takes a form in terms of the massive villas that are built to showcase wealth, or it takes form of the administration's building that remind us of the U.S. occupation, or it takes forms of sort of a poor, simplistic-looking building that remind us that this was the type of houses that were built for the slaves, in which the peasants still live in, and it tell us this is a poor country.
Port-au-Prince was founded 250 years ago by the French when they occupied the country, and it was, says Sylvain,
very beautiful historical city with amazing gingerbread houses. And what happened because of flood and earthquake, particularly the last major earthquake that we had in the late 1700s, most of Port-au-Prince was destroyed. And during the U.S. occupation, some of those architectures were changed. Then brick and block buildings became relatively fashionable because of modernity. Some of them with sort of a pseudo Roman architecture that depict this position of power with pillar, with high dome, for example, like the domes of the White House, for example.
Then came a coup d'etat, and in 1986, the fall of Duvalier's rule, and total chaos ensued in the country. Thousands of people migrated to Port-au-Prince, and it doubled in size to its current population of over 2 million, squashed into an area of around 14 square miles. And in migrating into the city, Haitians left behind a knowledge of building that suited the island.
And that is the aspect that is dying. Although we still have some great architects, but many of the older architects who sort of understood the environment knew that because of the constant rain and termites, there are certain materials one should not build with in a particular, you know, sort of plain or mountains and so forth. So this kind of knowledge is gone. And there are certain houses that used to be built on tilts so that when there is a flood, the house will remain solid. We no longer see those type of houses in Haiti, and people build upon any kind of land without knowing the history of the area, because the way that they built their houses in the provinces, which I must say, they build their houses with palm thatch that are extremely expendable and pliable, intertwine both bamboo and palm thatch that are pliable, and they kept their house is very cool. So the peasants, once they move into Port-au-Prince, not having enough houses or money, they will build a typical type of house within Port-au-Prince. So in Port-au-Prince, you'll see the tin roof, you see the natural stucco, and then you'll see the brick or block buildings, and then you'll see some of the old gingerbread, and then you'll see a massive villa that, if you were to take the picture, isolate some of the houses around it, you'll ask yourself, are you in Beverly Hills? So you have this kind of sort of, it's not really hybridity, but that share of space, the physical space between the rich, who are living in houses that were cost anywhere from 500,000 to 5 million. And then you have shanty towns. And many of the slums, particularly Cité Soleil, which is, you know, Sun City, it's sitting on landfill. when I was growing up, the area that is now called the City of God, Cité l'Éternel, used to be a swamp in which I used to see flamingos. Places such as Arcaye, for example, near the airport, Quadebouquet. This is a place where I remember as a child going hunting with my grandfather and his friends, hunting sort of peacock and wild turkeys. And it is a place where if one were to dig a well for about 50 feet or so, you will find water. But this kind of knowledge is not well known, and if it's known, people don't respect it because the need for land to build houses is so great.
Add to all this rampant deforestation of Haiti's once luscious hills and a form of construction that made the urban center ripe for disaster. Here's Ted Bardecke with the environmental organization Global Green that's headquartered in Santa Monica.
Unreinforced masonry buildings, they're just about the worst for an earthquake-prone place. Unreinforced masonry walls with concrete slab for floors. They just don't do well. And these days in Los Angeles, we don't build that way. We couldn't make it through code, but we've also learned that for residential and lower-rise buildings, stick frame with wood does okay as long as it's reinforced well. And steel does okay for our taller buildings.
The irony of all this is that the poorer the nation, the heavier the buildings in which we live.
Joe Osai-Addo is a Ghanaian architect who spent many years in L.A. before returning to his native country, and he's now working on low-cost housing solutions in Africa.
And this is due to the fact that we're using concrete, which is very, very heavy indeed. Now, to use this technology or this technique well, you have to have the perfect ratios of sand, cement, and water, and aggregates. And unfortunately, in most parts of the developing world, because these items or constituents are so expensive, everybody is trying to cheapen the mix. This is what happens when you cheapen the mix. The concrete beam will fail. And this is what has happened in Port-au-Prince.
But even in the darkness of this tragedy, the Haitian diaspora and many other people overseas who want to help, they're starting to think about what comes next. Here's Patrick Sylvain.
Well, what I hope, and this is something that is a very important question, because this is something in which the former Prime Minister, Michel Pierre-Louis, when I had last met with her, she had a plan to redesign Port-au-Prince in its historical context. Hopefully, she would be a major player in terms of the reconstruction of Port-au-Prince. And some of the architects and historians who still survive this catastrophe would help in creating a Port-au-Prince that is vibrant, that is historical, but also that respect the limit of space so that the place will not be overpopulated. Hoping that the U.S. and international organizations and different countries would help in putting the historical and aesthetic face into Port-au-Prince, but as well as creating beautiful houses for the poor and other folks as well outside of Port-au-Prince so that people can live in a space that is dignified.
Cameron Sinclair is the founder of Architecture for Humanity. That's a nonprofit based in San Francisco that draws on a global network to provide design solutions to humanitarian crises. He's already collaborating on intervention in Haiti.
We're the kind of construction and design partners for Yele Haiti, which a lot of people will know because they've been getting a lot of press. Their founder, Wyclef Jean, is Haitian-born and has really focused his...
The musician.
He's focused his life on trying to restore Haiti to the country it once was. And it's like a deep sense of, I don't know if it's irony, but, you know, we had spent the last year developing a youth sports facility that doubled as a disaster relief center.
Oh, my goodness.
For hurricane season. We had the land. We had the design. We're ready to go. And we were going to go into construction, either prior or post-hurricane season this year.
Whoa. So you'll be looking at doing more than just a football stadium that serves as disaster relief.
I mean, it's important that we not only respect the history of Haiti, but understand that there are many buildings that we just cannot build back. I mean, they're just structurally unsound. And, you know, the fact that the only earthquake engineer in the country said that the one structure that would remain would be the presidential palace, and that's gone too, we can understand the magnitude of this disaster.
So clearly there was a problem in current Haiti where people were building in a way that was slipshod and not in any way sensitive to the environment. Is there actually, out of this darkness, is there an opportunity for building better for Haiti?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, almost in every disaster zone that we've worked in, the quality of construction is elevated. You know, for the last decade, we've been looking and actually going back to areas that we've been a part of and other aid agencies have been a part of, and you see this elevation. And the nice thing is, you know, places like Haiti, they're not worried about copyright control. They will steal a good idea if they see one. So if you can do urban acupuncture and build some community structures that incorporate renewable energy systems and modern forms of construction technology while incorporating local materials, or at least low-cost materials, then those ideas will be stolen and replicated. So that's really important, and I think it will happen. The only hurdle in this, and there are many others, you know, this is not an easy thing to do. I mean, I know kind of our organization seems like we kind of draw pretty pictures and then we kind of build buildings, but it's an incredibly arduous task to try and rebuild at this magnitude. The big stumbling block is politics. If you do not have a strong political will, then, you know, there's going to be no codes, there's going to be no support, there's going to be no infrastructure, and all of those things are going to factor into the planning process that we're going to have to face. So, you know, most of our projects are off the grid, not because we're trying to be cool and green and sustainable, but we're trying to give the communities the equity and the support they need to go, whether they have a strong or unstable government. So we have to really think about these things in the long term, even if those hurdles exist or not.
I'm Frances Anderton, you're listening to DNA on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. We're talking about Haiti and thoughts on rebuilding. For many of us in the US, the most immediate comparison to Haiti that comes to mind is Katrina, albeit the scale between the two is vastly different. But is there anything that we can learn from our experience in New Orleans? Alejandro Lillo is LA partner for Graf. That's the architecture firm that co-created Brad Pitt's Make It Right home building project in New Orleans' Ninth Ward.
The thing to really reflect upon, or the lesson learned in New Orleans, once the spectacle was over, once the news had hit and the spectacle of television was over and 2 months had passed or 3 months had passed, the real issue is to maintain focus on the region so that rebuilding efforts, once the initial catastrophe has been dealt with, are not forgotten. Because ultimately that's what we realized in New Orleans, was that, yeah, although our initial attempts, I think, to provide rescue efforts in the beginning were certainly lackluster, I think where we ultimately all fell very short was in following up on this and creating a sustainable, permanent solution that bettered a condition for an incredibly vast group of people. I mean, and what we're looking at Haiti is just significantly larger. So it's going to need a concerted and maintained focus.
The major difference is that the earthquake in Haiti was an equal opportunity disaster.
Ted Bardaki.
Earthquakes often are.
They're sort of social levelers because they're physical levelers.
That's right. And because of a history of pushing poor people into low-lying areas in that city, poor people suffered to a much greater extent in New Orleans during Katrina. And what is interesting is to see in Haiti whether the fact that it hit all social and economic classes has any consequence for rebuilding. Now, you mentioned what might we learn. Well, I think that one thing that we've learned in New Orleans is that we needed to build back responsibly with higher levels of construction and durability. But I think the other thing that those of us who've been involved in New Orleans recognize is that there also has to be a long-term view of the restoration of the wetlands in the Gulf of Mexico and in the sort of the tidal flows at the end of the Mississippi. And that all of this very smart and good rebuilding in New Orleans may end up ultimately being destroyed if we don't have that natural protection. So the analogy here that I would draw is that all of our strong and good new buildings in Port-au-Prince, if we even get them, will ultimately be for naught if there's not a major campaign for reforestation in the hillsides around the capital city, such that the future landslides won't destroy these great new buildings.
For now, goals are modest. Here's Cameron Sinclair.
Right now, the real need is to look at a couple of things. One is we're putting together an earthquake-resistant housing manual with a Haitian group called AIDG, who've been working on appropriate technology for a long time. We're also taking the work that we did after Katrina that was extremely successful and probably our greatest success after Katrina was starting housing resource centers in very kind of affected urban nodes. So we had one in New Orleans and we had one in Biloxi. And we could bring in design professionals, volunteers, builders over the course of the rebuilding process, which can take anywhere from 3 to 5 years. So we're in the midst of doing that. And that should really be how our work is going to play out.
To many of us, it would seem a no-brainer that the most basic building solution for Port-au-Prince will be strict building codes. Not so easy, says Global Green's Ted Bardicky, who's been involved with post-disaster recovery in Venezuela and Mexico, as well as New Orleans.
Writing the code is one thing that pretty much anybody can do. The enforcement of code takes two things that are in short supply in Haiti. It takes money, because you have to have inspectors and really make it part of what goes on in the general process of building. The other thing is there's a culture of corruption. Codes don't get enforced in a culture of corruption because people can get paid to look the other way. You know, in China, in the aftermath of the earthquakes there, was that just a year ago? It was understood that the building codes in that part of China were actually quite robust, but the buildings had not been built to code because of corrupt practices. And so to just say, oh, we need better laws, is not really getting at the root of the matter, which is poverty. If you look at the history of disaster response in poor and developing countries, so far, our experience is that people build right back in harm's way, that the long-term impacts of a disaster are more social and political and economic than they are physical. Those disasters have incredible political consequences. We saw that in Mexico City in the aftermath of the 85 earthquake, where the government essentially hid and abdicated their responsibility for relief. And what it birthed was an incredible social movement at the neighborhood level, generated an entire social movement that became the base of political change and the incredible election in 1988 in Mexico. Similarly, we can see in Venezuela the roots of Chavism in the 1999 landslides. And again, I didn't see any pattern of change in that architecture or change in the location of people where they were building. Instead, the impact was, again, social and political and to some extent economic.
So based on everything you've said, anyone who looks at this, particularly anyone who wants to see a transition from poor building to good, regionally appropriate, environmentally sustainable building. Anyone that looks at Port-au-Prince as potentially a tabula rasa where one can rebuild in a very positive way might be just being a bit too over-optimistic.
I think that our history has shown that that kind of building would take the level of resources that I don't think are going to be available in the aftermath of all the resources that are going to be spent on relief.
Much of the early thinking about Haiti is about how to make Port-au-Prince a more decent and safe place for its millions to live. But, say Patrick Sylvain and Ghana's Joe Addo, one of the causes of the devastation was overpopulation, and a more productive solution for the future might be to depopulate the city and move people back to the land. Here's Joe Addo.
It's very common knowledge in the developing world about the pressures on our cities from the rural areas, and most governments pay lip service to it, but nothing really gets done about it. And I think this tragic, unfortunate incident last week just demonstrates a series of calamities that this rural-urban migration actually causes.
Patrick Sylvain.
I think what happened in Haiti, if the world is really to take notice, as far as sort of this massive urbanization, the chaotic movements towards the center, and so forth. So the lesson would be a complete decentralization. You cannot have a city in which all of the important offices are there, including for birth certificate, ID, whether it's passport or driver's license. Decentralization would have to be extremely important. We need to shift resources as far as, since it is an agrarian society, where centers of production have to be relocated, cannot simply be in Port-au-Prince. And therefore, by changing centers of production, we would hopefully change the architecture, because you need to have the houses for the administrations and therefore houses for people, since you can have new types of migration, streets. So the aesthetic, hopefully, would have to change and cannot be that of a typical third world society in which streets were made or paved for the boogies at the time in the 17th and 18th century. So now we need to think of changing, rebuilding architecture to meet the challenges that we are going to face in the 21st century.
It's a lesson, says Sylvain, that has global implications as cities are swelling all over the developing world.
Well, what I would simply say is for the world in terms of this catastrophic moment, not to think that it is charity they are giving to Haiti, but to really think in terms of what has been the collective responsibility of the world, particularly in sort of starting in the 1600s and all the way to the 1900s, to what sort of the Western world has done to the third world. Of course, Haitians are responsible for their own sovereignty and their own governance because we've really mismanaged the country. However, what France and the United States have done to Haiti in terms of whether it is the concentration of production in one particular city, whether it is the support of dictatorial regime, or the sort of the absence of proper policy, now is the time to really rethink, right, their policy and to really approach not only Haiti but the rest of the world in a way that is humane and where the human condition is front and center, but also to say, you know what, we have messed up in the past, and now is the time to really help rebuild Haiti, and perhaps, with what's going on as far as the world economy is concerned, maybe the thousands and millions of Americans who are unemployed might be able to find jobs in Haiti.
Ted Bardakey.
It's true that there is a renewed sense of the need, particularly as we become a majority urban world, that housing the urban poor in durable and environmentally benign, at least, if not friendly, housing is critical. What I don't think we should forget is that in the late 1960s, there was also a consensus around the world that this was a critical issue, and a lot of great experimentation happened, and a lot of very interesting lessons were learned. But ultimately, what I think came out of that movement historically was an understanding that the urban poor knew pretty much how to take care of itself in terms of its patterns of urban settlement. And squatters' rights became a very important thing in terms of regularizing land tenure. The upshot of that is that people in developing countries, but also people who work there, have become a little bit wary of the top-down, one-size-fits-all response. And the social organization that takes place in urban slums is been seen as a rich vein of experience to draw upon in planning further building. I think there's a couple of things that makes Haiti potentially different. Is number one, those social networks that existed have been severely disrupted by death and by this disaster. And so there is a moment where new networks need to be created, and to the extent that global better ideas can intervene and help stitch back together those social networks. The other sort of hope is that, unlike a place like Thailand or Venezuela, the political class in Haiti is extremely weak. And there's very limited ability on the part of the Haitian authorities to sort of impose their own ideas of how rebuilding should take place. I have no doubt that there will be an incredible examination of all of these issues. But when cement starts to be mixed with sand and aggregate and lime, and rebar gets to be mixed in with that, I'm not yet sure.
That was Ted Bardaki of Global Green, concluding our show on Haiti and thoughts on its rebuilding. You can find links to organizations that are helping Haiti on our website. The show was produced by Ray Guana with production assistance from Melissa Walker. The consulting producer is Jennifer Farrow. Thanks to Nan Sherry Lieberman for managing the website. And to Tom Schnabel for giving us the song Merci Bon Dieu by the Tombeau International Ensemble that we used in the mid-show. You can podcast DNA, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. Or you can get it from iTunes. And if you'd like to comment on a show, post your thoughts at kcrw.com/DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Join me next month for more DNA.